I think this is a good place. Maybe you have some questions. Ask questions about what I discussed so far. Tomorrow I'll kind of go more into the organization of the precepts and, you know, how, and you'll see, you know, this development of the precepts and the development of the communities, and they had to go along with each other. Okay. You have questions?
So one of the things that I keep thinking about is the Kshuni issue. You know, and how sometimes because of circumstances, that there's time for the community to make a decision. It seemed like in the beginning, from the story, it sounds like they really, it sort of evolved naturally and organically.
Mm-hmm.
And was most of this after the Buddha's parinirvana, they made this decision as a body, or were there seniors who made the decision, or because it seems like they had a lot of flexibility due to the culture and the times and the needs of the community, and it seems as time has gone on, things get a little bit more rigid and concretized, so that when there are necessities for change,
So you're saying at the time of the Buddha, the development seemed quite organic, and then afterwards things seemed to get solidified or rigid, become more rigid. I think this is true. You know, if you look back at the development of any group, the initial founder, when the initial founder was there, that person brought so much inspiration, and everybody just followed the advice and the teachings and the instructions of that particular individual because they trusted them so much. They had the same teacher. So the authority was invested with that particular individual by virtue of their spiritual realizations and who they were as a person, that so many people came to them to study and to learn and to receive guidance. Okay, so the issue of authority was very much with that one person, and everybody would follow it because everybody respected them. Okay? Then, and so that person, you know, a precept would be made in one way, but then if another situation happened, it would go to that, to the Buddha in this case, who would say, okay, well, this is a similar situation, but it's different, so we readjust the precept like this. And because everybody had this kind of faith and confidence in the Buddha as their teacher, then they would all go along with these readjustments. Okay? Now, what happens when a teacher passes away, and, you know, I'll kind of get into this while I'm getting into it right now, it looks like, is a group at first has, you know, it's like our teacher isn't here, the center pillar around whom we've all gathered isn't here, and there's like, what are we going to do? And so you saw this happen, actually, right after the Buddha's parinirvana. Is they all were in shock over the death of their teacher. And then there was one monk who kind of said, well, actually it's not too bad that he died because now we don't have to follow all these uptight precepts. So then Mahakashapa said, whoa, you know, that's not a very good way to think. And if many people think like this, then the dispensation, the sasana, is just going to scatter because everybody's going to do their own trip and make up their own thing. And so he convened the first council. And so just, you know, right after the Buddha's parinirvana, I think it was just within a few months, they, you know, you had the 500 arhats coming together, and they recited, you know, Pali recited the Vinaya, the Ananda recited the sutras, so that they codified everything. So that, first of all, by said, you know, codifying all the Vinaya things, okay, now here are the guidelines by which we're going to live. This is what the Buddha said. The Buddha was our teacher. We're all going to follow this. We're not going to do our own trip. Okay, and with the Dharma, here are the teachings. This is what the Buddha said. This is how he said to practice. We're not going to make up our own teachings. And so if you get all these things codified very early on, it preserves the identity of the group as one. It forms the group around certain acceptable behaviors so that there's a certain conformity and the group holds together as a group. Two, and then it also makes it so that they're all practicing the same teachings, and it prevents people from just going, well, I heard the Buddha say this, and I think he really meant that, and well, I, you know. Because you see what's happening now as Buddhism's coming to America. People pick and choose the different teachings, you know, and teachings that they don't like so much, they just forget to teach, or they say the Buddha didn't really mean this, what he means is that, and that happens to coincide, of course, with what I believe. And, you know, so you get this disintegration of the body of the teachings, and you get a disintegration of the behavior, because there, you know, unless you have some authority that everybody's going to follow, things are going to splinter. So when the Buddha passed away, right before his parinirvana, he very explicitly did not appoint a successor. Yeah, he didn't appoint, you know, okay, you're in charge, everybody listens to you. But rather he said, let the Dharma be your guide, let the Vinaya be your guide. And he had already set up the Sangha community in a very democratic way, whereby they had to function together by consensus. Okay, so he was trusting the wisdom of the group rather than appointing one individual as a successor. So now when you have the wisdom of the group, the issue of authority changes, doesn't it? It's no longer one person, and it's the group. And now people have to trust the group. They don't just trust their teacher. So it's a very different thing. And so then, of course, the group is going to be much slower to change because there isn't one person who's the central authority who's going to say so. You have to have the consensus of the entire group. You have to take everybody into consideration. So change is going to be a lot slower. What I found very interesting, just to bring some other examples, I remember once I was, when I was in New York, I was asked to go to speak to this group. It was called Wisdom's Goldenrod. And they had two teachers. What were their names? I don't know, Anthony and Paul or somebody, you know. But their two teachers had just passed away. And they were going through this same kind of thing that I'm sure the Sangha went through when the Buddha passed away, because their teachers hadn't appointed one person as a successor, and they were all kind of, you know, okay, well, I heard Antonio say this, and this is what he said, and this is what he meant, and this is what we will all practice. And they were kind of codifying it. And, you know, you don't get this same mode of development as you do when there's a teacher that everybody trusts who's a realized being. Okay, so even though you may have many realized beings in the group, there were many realized arhats after the Buddha passed away. You know, none of them had the profound respect that the Buddha commanded. Okay, so the whole authority system changed. And, for example, when Lama Yeshe passed away, many people disrobed. It was like, you know, Lama was charismatic, they were in the Dharma because of Lama. When Lama was no longer there, they had a hard time switching their refuge from the personality of their teacher to the teaching of their teacher. And when your refuge isn't in the teaching, but it's in, you know, the kind of inspiration and charisma and faith in the teacher as a living being, then when that teacher's no longer there, your practice goes into crisis. And so people disrobed. So there's always this process that goes on whenever, a charismatic leader passes away. So even when Reverend Clarissa, you know, when she was talking about how when she first came, Reverend Master Jiu was in charge. But then she passed away and Reverend Master Echo was elected. But then some people saw Reverend Master Echo as their Dharma colleague, and they weren't he wasn't gonna be their abbot. And so they went out and started different priories, but they banded together as an order of Buddha's contemplatives. Okay, but so many people left the priory after she died, or some people, I think, probably went back to lay life because she wasn't alive anymore. So there's always this thing that goes on. At our recent monastic conference, Venerable Heng Liang talked about the passing away of their master, you know, Master Hua, who was head of the Dharma, Dharma Realm Society? Yeah, Dharma Realm is a city of 10,000 Buddhas, but they also have many other, you know, temples. And he passed away, and then all of a sudden, you know, well, who's going to ordain everybody? And, you know, are they all going to have their own, all the senior disciples going to have their own students? And so it's very interesting because each group decided it differently. You know, in the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives, where Reverend Clarissa is, the seniors, different seniors became masters, and they all had their own disciples. Okay, but they're still functioning together as an order, and they meet together, and they have their common guidelines that they follow. In the Dharma Realm Association, they decided that none of the senior disciples could have their own students. And so all of them would be extremely wary if any of the others started having their own disciples. So then they say Master Hua is still, you know, he's the one, even though he's not here, he's the one who's giving the ordination. That's not actually according to Vinaya, because it has to be a living master, but they figured that was the way to keep themselves all together as a group, is nobody would have their own disciples. They would still, everybody would follow Master Hua. Yeah. If you see Goenkaji's organization, now he doesn't have monastics, but even how his organization is right now, he has many senior students, and they're sometimes called teachers, but actually they aren't allowed to teach. Every single course is taught by Goenka on tape. Yeah. None of his disciples, no matter how long they've been with him, are allowed to teach a course. They answer questions, but all the teachings are given on tape or by video by Goenka, because that was his way. If he wants the meditation done exactly like this, so everybody hears it from him, on the recorder, the video, and then senior students just are allowed to answer questions. Okay? So every group has, you know, their own way. In the case of FPMT, you know, Lama died, then Dzogchen Rinpoche came in, and at first people were going, well, you know, they didn't relate to Lama Dzogchen the same way they related to Lama Yeshe. So many people left, but then some of them, you know, transferred their faith to Lama Dzogchen. Then many new people came. The whole organization changed because it had a new leader. So it's just an interesting thing when you think about group dynamics and look at it from a sociological point of view or a group dynamic point of view. This, you know, things change when a founding leader is no longer there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and each group works it out in their own way.
And the thing, but as far as the Bhikkhuni, there's also some cultural trappings too that are also being influencing the decision making too.
Yeah.
Seems to complicate the issue.
Yeah, right. So there's definitely cultural trappings. Because in ancient culture, you know, women are not seen as capable. You know, even though the Buddha said that women could attain enlightenment, the Buddha very clearly said that. You know, still from the cultural viewpoint, they're seen as being weaker, having more afflictions or whatever. So there's that influencing it, you know, kind of cultural prejudice influencing it. In the case of the Tibetans, regarding the Bhikshuni issue, they're a refugee society where they're trying to not change anything because they want to go back to pre-59 Tibet, which is gone forever. But so they're hesitant to change anything, but things are changing all around them. Their own monasteries are changing. Okay. So, you know, yeah, you have all sorts of different factors influencing this. Yeah. And then you have the presence of people like the Westerners coming in and saying, well, where are the Bhikshunis? And where are the female lamas? And how come, you know, everybody in a position of authority is male? And how come when His Holiness teaches, everybody sitting around Him is male? You know, and now this is new for a culture to have a completely outside group with different values come in and ask questions. Okay? So you're having that go on at the same time. And then they're kind of stuck because the benefactors have a lot of influence. Well, some of the benefactors are Westerners who want equality, and some of the benefactors are Chinese who have the same values. So, well, which group's going to influence, and how are we going to do this? And yeah, and then you have the whole thing of, well, what about, you know, Tibetan Buddhism in the West, the centers in the West? You know, there's no central authority. We are not members of one large congregation. You know, we don't receive any direction. There isn't any institution that we all belong to that's run out of the central Tibetan government. Okay, because they're very involved in their own affairs, and we're kind of seen as, well, we'll teach them, why not? But, you know, there's no institutional control, and we have a different culture and different cultural values, and Tibetan Buddhism is spreading here, and what's going to happen? Yeah. And what I find interesting about what's happening here is that you have monastics from different traditions being in so much greater touch with each other than our Asian teachers have ever been. Now, because traditionally the Asian teachers, you know, there's no transportation, you know, except your yak, you know, to get from place to place. You know, there's no telephones and cell phones and fax machines and email, and they all speak their own language. There's no common language. So, you know, people in Thailand and Tibet, they're never going to meet. They're never going to talk to each other. They only know about each other's traditions by the prejudices and stories that have been passed down from one generation to another generation. You know, so they think, oh, the Tibetans are all degenerate. They practice tantra, so they're all sleeping with each other and drinking. And then the Tibetans say, well, the Thais, you know, they're just very uptight and take things literally and can't be flexible, and they don't have the right view of emptiness anyway. And it's just all prejudice, you know, passed down from one generation to the next because they never meet. And here, what I think is so remarkable about our monastic conferences that we have every year is that we meet together, we practice together, we live together during that time, we're learning from each other, you know. You have Reverend Clarissa from a different tradition coming and spending time here. You know, you have people from different places going and practicing in different traditions. I was in Thailand for 2 weeks, you know. Last year, one of my teachers told me to go there, and you know, you have people practicing in different traditions. You have the monastics cooperating, yeah. So we're all influencing each other, and in ways that didn't happen before with our own teachers. Yeah. And also, what I find quite interesting is when we first started having these monastic conferences, the first ones, Theravadas didn't come. Shasta Abbey folks, they didn't come. City of 10,000 Buddhas, they didn't come. Thich Nhat Hanh's people, they didn't come. Okay. What's happened is as the leaders have passed away, the groups themselves have changed. Okay. So the people from Shasta Abbey, when their master passed away, then something changed, or when their master was very ill, the organization began to change. They began to come to these meetings. You know, the Theravada people, as His Holiness got to be more well known and so on, and there were different contexts, and they started coming. City of 10,000 Buddhas, when their teacher passed away, then they started opening up to other traditions. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Thich Nhat Hanh's people have come to one of the monastic conferences, but all the other ones, they already have had their own things that they had to be at and so on. They haven't ventured out. It's going to be curious what happens when Thay passes away. We all hope he lives a long life, but you know, there's impermanence. So what's going to happen to their organization? Will they start coming to our monastic conferences? Will FPMT people start coming to the monastic conferences more? You know, now not many of them are very interested in coming, you know, because they have their own organization, their own teacher. But will that change when their teacher passes away? So, you know, you have all these social factors and different factors influencing how, you know, the connections and how we learn from each other, what we learn from each other.
Because that has also very, very Western. I mean, group process is so much a part of Western culture in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting peer support, colleague support, mentoring each other.
Right.
Very much a Western culture.
Yeah. Yeah. When I talked to Wei Ling, you know, and Sunan, my friends in Singapore, we had a fascinating discussion once, because we were talking about, you know, Buddhism in Taiwan. And there it's very much, there is a abbot to the temple who sets the rules, you know, and everybody follows that particular person. And, you know, in the West, it's a little bit different. People have more their own opinions, and they have to discuss things a little bit more. You know, even if you have a central leader, still there has to be more discussion. Whereas, you know, in Taiwan, according to the culture, a master says this, and everybody follows along. Yeah. Yeah, Wei Ling thought it was so funny that, you know, that the schedule had to be discussed. You know, she said, you know, we come from, the teacher says this is the schedule and everybody does it. There's no discussion involved. Yeah. So, yeah, very much different cultures.
Mm-hmm. Were all the precepts made in the time of the Buddha's life?
The question is, were all the precepts made at the time of the Buddha's life? Well, according to tradition, i.e. party line, yes, they were all made at the time of the Buddha's life. Now, according to some of the scholars who do textual analysis, it could appear like there were some things that either were made later on, or they became interpreted in a certain way, or became more prominent, or became more solid later on as the Sangha developed. Okay, so one incredibly interesting example is the 8 Garu Dharmas. Okay, so these are supposed to be the 8 precepts that the nuns keep that were allegedly given to Mahaprajapati, the Buddha's aunt and stepmother, that constituted her ordination. Okay, so according to the scriptures, the Buddha gave these as, you know, the stipulation for her ordination. What's interesting is when you start comparing the Vinayas from the different traditions, because, you know, later on as Buddhism spread, you got the development of different traditions, either because of some doctrinal differences or geographical differences. The story of the first ordination differs in the different traditions. In some traditions, the 8 Garu Dharmas were given only to Mahaprajapati, nobody else. The 500 Sakya women were ordained by the monks. In another one, the 500 Sakya women who came with her were ordained by Mahaprajapati and the monks. In other traditions, both Mahaprajapati and the 500 women were all accepted the 8 Guru Dhammas. So just this initial story, it differs from tradition to tradition. Okay. Which one's true? You got me. Also, when you look at the 8 Garu Dharmas, for example, one of the Garu Dharmas is that the nuns, you know, to become a nun, one needs to go through this probationary period of Shikshamana. Well, if this was made at the time of the Buddha and constituted the ordination of the first nun, Mahaprajapati, you know, there were no bhikshunis around to give the Shikshamana ordination, and Mahaprajapati herself didn't have the Shikshamana ordination, and neither did the 500 Sakya women. So where did this come about that they had to have it? Or, you know, another one is that the ordination is given by the monks and the nuns. Well, again, there wasn't a community of nuns to help give the ordination. So why would the Buddha give a vow that, you know, you accept it as part of your ordination, that to become a bhikshuni you have to be ordained by a community of monks and a community of nuns if there's no other community of nuns at the time you're taking the ordination? Okay, so some people have these kinds of doubts, and so they may say, well, these may have been added on later, you know, as a way of setting up the relationship of the bhikshuni community to the bhikshu community, you know. And then you also have the fact that some of these eight gurudhammas, some of them appear as precepts, but they're actually auxiliary. They're not major classes of precepts. Yeah, they're ones that if you break, you confess to an individual bhikshuni. So they're not a major class of precepts. And yet here they are in the context of the eight gurudharmas, made as this essential thing, you know, important thing that's going to influence the whole bhikshuni order forever. And then some of these eight gurudharmas aren't even mentioned in the regular precepts. The only mention you have of those particular things are in the eight gurudharmas themselves. You don't find them anywhere else in the Vinaya. Okay? So, you know, if you do textual analysis, you come up with these kinds of questions. Now, of course, in the Tibetan tradition, you don't do textual analysis because it's based on the assumption that everything was said by the Buddha and it was passed down without one single syllable ever changing in the last 2600 years. Yeah. And I remember asking one Rinpoche about this one time. I said, don't you think that, you know, it was passed down orally, that sometimes they might have had a slip of the tongue, or when it was written that they might have, you know, sometimes left out a passage or done something? And he said, yeah, that probably happens, but because we're in no position to say where the mistakes are, then we just accept everything as they are. And then they tell you on top of that, that if you say that something that is the Dharma is not the Dharma, then you're, you know, abandoning the Dharma, and that's a ticket to the hell realms. So it gets kind of interesting when you're talking about these things. So that's why I try and present it as, well, this group says this, and this group says this, and I'm not saying anything, okay? but it is interesting when you look at it from all these different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's just sit quietly.